Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who is a senior correspondent and associate editor at The Washington Post, where he's worked since 1994. He's reported from more than a dozen countries and has served as the newspaper's bureau chief in Baghdad, Cairo, and Southeast Asia. He's the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and one of the New York Times' 10 Best Books of 2007. His most recent book just out is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rajiv Chandrasekaran.
Good to be out here, Ian.
And clearly Afghanistan barely was mentioned at the Republican convention. In fact, the White House has pointed this out. Clint Eastwood, in his torturous 12 minutes of incoherence, talking to the empty chair, addressed the invisible Barack Obama, saying, you know, didn't you learn from what the Russians were doing? Of course, somehow Clint forgot that George W. Bush started that war. But there was quite a lot of historical amnesia at the convention. What was your sense? Because my understanding is what sold Clint Eastwood on joining supporting the Romney-Ryan ticket was they both told him that on day one they would get out of Afghanistan. What's your understanding of why this was a taboo subject at the convention?
Well, you know, I'm not entirely clear that if Mitt Romney were elected, he'd be out of Afghanistan on day one. In fact, I think far from it. I think if you look at Mitt Romney's other statements about the war, and I underscore other because there really were no statements out of Romney's mouth in Tampa, as you correctly stated. Romney would, in his heart of hearts, I believe, would want to keep on fighting through the end of 2014 when NATO members have agreed that the conventional combat mission is to end there. He's been critical of President Obama for imposing a deadline on the troop surge, a date by which troops would start coming home. And he's indicated that he'd favor potentially a slower reduction of forces between now and the end of 2014. So this was what makes Clint Eastwood's comments so curious. I mean, when I heard them on Thursday night, I just about rolled out of bed. It was later here in the East Coast, obviously, and it was, you know. But I'll tell you, a couple of things were remarkable about that. One was what would seem to be the sort of the mindless clapping of the audience when Eastwood was drawing the Russian parallel. We should have listened to the Russians. Well, that's something that people who are pretty stridently against the war say. I'd venture to say that the vast majority of people in that crowd are probably of the let's keep on fighting persuasion, yet they just sort of went along and clapped. And again, when Eastwood made reference to troops coming home very quickly, again, there was a lot of applause. Now, there is a faction within the Republican Party that no longer believes this war is worth fighting, that it's too costly, that the United States should focus its military resources on more threats that are more central to the United States as opposed to trying to nation build halfway around the world. But certainly the message that Eastwood was projecting was something that's not in keeping with where where candidate Romney is and what he would do if he were elected president.
So, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, just to touch on your book, because it's an extraordinary catalog of serial blunders that have mired the United States in its longest war, and of course now we're witnessing the ultimate tragic absurdity of the killings, the fratricidal killings of NATO soldiers by their Afghan partners. Nothing, I think, puts the futility of it all in greater stark relief than that. But just to go back to the beginning, because, you know, the book is, there aren't too many heroes in the book, but to some extent Richard Holbrook comes across as somebody at least understood what needed to be done and was never able to accomplish it. I recall, though, that when Holbrook first got the portfolio, the first thing he wanted to do was to make a macro deal with India over Kashmir, understanding that the Pakistanis had their interests in controlling or at least having influence over Afghanistan, and that until you got rid of the malignant influence of the Pakistani army over Pakistan's politics, you wouldn't have a snowball's chance in hell of succeeding in Afghanistan. And what happened there? Just because my understanding, you know, that basically the Indian lobby blocked it. I don't know what happened, but it never got off the ground.
Ian, you're totally right about that. Holbrook did believe that the path to peace in Afghanistan runs through Kashmir, which is essentially at the heart of the India-Pakistan conflict. Totally right. And Holbrook believed that that needed to be addressed. And yes, you're right. The Indian government did not want its disputes with Pakistan to be part of a broader multinational effort to try to pacify Afghanistan, did not want to be told that it would have to make any compromises to help save Afghanistan, and did not want the United States and other powers to be involved in the settlement of that dispute. The New Delhi government believes very strongly that that conflict and that dispute needs to be handled bilaterally between India and Pakistan. But you're touching, Ian, here on a fundamental truth about this part of the world, and I write about it in my book Little America. You know, there's no way Pakistan will ever behave appropriately, will ever be an honest broker with regard to Afghanistan until the conflict with India is resolved. And it comes down to this very simple truth, which is the Pakistani military believes that it faces an existential threat from India. Put aside all the many statements from Indian officials that they have no interest in marching into Pakistan and in assuming control of that incredibly troubled country, and the reality that any conflict there would involve nuclear weapons, and, you know, it's just not going to happen. The Pakistani military has convinced the public in Pakistan that this is a very real threat, and it begins with Kashmir. And so, as a result, it cannot afford to have a peaceful Afghanistan. Why? Because if Afghanistan were left to its own devices, the Afghan government would be much more closely aligned with India than with Pakistan for a variety of reasons. And so for the Pakistani military, it can't afford to have on its rear flank a country that would be closer to its rival than itself. And so the Pakistanis insist on stirring the pot in Afghanistan, supporting the Taliban insurgency in an effort to gain leverage in Afghanistan. And so the only way you really get the Pakistanis to be honest brokers is to get this big issue of Kashmir off the table. But the Indians don't want to go there, and Holbrook, despite his initial efforts there, was very quickly slapped down, both by India as well as others in the Obama administration, that recognized that if you tried to take that on, it would be a years-long task. It could potentially even make trying to solve, you know, the disputes between Israel and the Palestinians seem like a walk in the park. And so it was pushed off the table.
Well, the book, though, your book, your latest book, Rajiv Chandrasekharan, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, the title itself goes back to this surreal little American community that was created by the Morrison Knudsen company that helped build the Hoover Dam and the San Francisco Bay Bridge. They were hired by the king of Afghanistan in the 50s, and they dammed the Helmand River and created this agricultural paradise through irrigation. But of course, it's eventually the salt deposits ruined the fertility of the topsoil, and eventually the only crop that could be grown is opium. And we know that that's been fueling the conflict. But so much of the story which your book brings to the table, which I hadn't heard about before, is the bureaucratic infighting and the fecklessness of AID. And why is it that they couldn't have substituted opium with cotton? That would have solved so much of the problems.
This is one of the most, ludicrous tales that I tell in the book. The Afghans wanted to grow cotton. It was a crop that they had grown in the 60s and 70s in the South. It's a crop that's ideally suited to the climatic and conditions, the soil conditions. It's labor intensive, which means it can put regions of disaffected young men to work, the same young men who are planting roadside bombs today. It was perfect in many aspects. The problem was the U.S. Agency for International Development just hated it. It hated it because it thought that cotton just wouldn't be competitive on global markets for Afghanistan. Well, fine. Nobody's asking Afghanistan to export this or to compete in world markets. They just grow the cotton so they could stitch police uniforms and stitch carpets, the stuff that the people there have done for centuries. And then the U.S. government trotted out another excuse, which was an act of Congress passed in 1986 that essentially is a protectionist law aimed to protect king cotton in the United States. And they said, well, because of this law, we can't do anything about it. But, of course, the White House could have sought a waiver. But USA didn't want to fight for it. And, it's one of these many stories I lay out in the book as to how we missed these really vital opportunities over the last couple of years. Ian, I thought when I first traveled to Afghanistan in 2009, soon after Obama was inaugurated, that this administration would do things differently, would get things right in Afghanistan. And, they sent a lot of talented people. But ultimately, the federal bureaucracy failed us. The Pentagon sent troops to the wrong places. USAID tried to pour too much money into the country. The State Department was too slow in dispatching people to work with the military. And ultimately, you had a White House that really just bought into what the Pentagon wanted, as opposed to sticking to its guns and listening to others. I mean, had Obama listened to Vice President Biden, to others of his civilian advisors, we wouldn't have surged this way. We wouldn't be spending this much money. And we likely would be in a pretty similar situation to where we are today. It's hard to look at this troop surge, the civilian surge, the surge of billions of reconstruction dollars, and say that it's really improved the situation there.
And of course, we would have fewer than the over 2,000 American dead and the over 1,000 NATO dead. And meanwhile, of course, Karzai and his family and cronies continue to loot the country. It's hard to see any good that will come from this. We've only got a couple of seconds here, but can you, just in the post-conflict, if indeed they'll resume a civil war, the Taliban won't necessarily win, will it? Will we be back to a kind of Northern Alliance versus the Taliban? Is that what we're going to expect after 2014?
I think you'll see some of that. I think you'll also see intra-Pashtun fighting, the Taliban versus other tribal militias, rival factions of the Taliban fighting each other, various groups of Afghan security forces fighting one another. It's going to be a messy, chaotic environment. They're not going to be clear dividing lines. A lot of people are going to be fighting a lot of people. It'll feel like the mid-1990s. And we're going to step back and say, all right, well, You know, is it mission accomplished? They're fighting amongst themselves, so it means they're not really trying to plot attacks beyond Afghan soil. But you know, you're going to look and say, boy, we sacrificed a few thousand American lives, tens of thousands of our service members badly wounded, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, and for what? And I think there will be a lingering set of questions there for the American people to address. And I only wish that both candidates were talking about this a little bit on the stump. You know, I know it's not politically expedient for either one of them to really address this, but the American people deserve a frank discussion of this war. We still have more than 70,000 troops there. Regardless of who wins, they're going to keep troops there for some years.
Well, I'm afraid, Rajiv, and I hate to do this, we have to wrap up here, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rajiv Chandrasekaran, a senior correspondent and associate editor at The Washington Post. He is the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, Inside Iraq's Green Zone, and his latest book just out is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about cyber wars underway beneath the radar.
After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins?